Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, October 30th. I'm Ray Graff. Time again for another science forum, and the experts are here. They have reassembled, and they were in pieces, frankly, but they're back together now, and they're ready to field your scientific questions. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. If you have anything at all in the physical world that you're curious about, you can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org for the email, or the number is 800-348-2551. The Science Forum, and your calls coming up after the news. Oh, hello again. Welcome back to the show. It's Vox Pop, and boy, I tell you what, it's the Science Forum today, and this is going to be a barn burner. I'm Ray Graff. We have our Science Forum team here ready to respond to your questions, and we'll respond accurately, presumably. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can email the program as well if you wish, voxpop@wamc.org. It's voxpop@wamc.org if you want to email. And, you know, keep them relatively brief, no profanity, etc. Or you can call 800-348-2551. All right, let's have our team of scientists sign in, please.
Roger Giaboni from Rogers High Fidelity in North Adams, Massachusetts.
Hello, Roger.
I'm Jim Pickett. I'm an organic chemist, mostly retired now.
Hello, Jim.
And I'm Ed Stander from SUNY Cobleskill, geology, astronomy, and today I am also focusing on Barbara, who's not here.
Yes, Barbara did not make it, and howdy, Ed. Yeah, Barbara was a scratch today, but will be back with us next month. All right, so Jim, before we get rolling here, you had some homework or something exciting to tell us about that I forgot. You mentioned it, but I forgot what it was.
Well, it has to do with the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for this year.
I did not win
this
year.
Which was a few weeks. Yeah, I didn't win that either. I had my tuxedo rented.
Ah, rats. Let me ask you a question. Yeah. These people who win these prizes, they win about $1 million, right?
Yeah,
what do you do with it? Do they just go to the track, or do they have to spend it on scientific enterprises?
No, they can go to the track if they want.
Oh, that's
amazing.
They can
do whatever they like.
Do scientists like the party? I know you do, Ed.
Oh, yeah.
But, are they, when they get together for the Christmas party, do they go nuts?
Probably not as nuts as a lot of others.
As radio people do.
Yeah.
But we don't get invited to parties, so it works out pretty well. All right, so anyway, who won, why, and whatever?
Well, it was split three ways.
They can't give them too much money because they'll spend it.
Right, they'll go to Vegas.
Yeah. So it has to do with what are called metal organic frameworks.
Okay.
They're related to a mineral type called zeolites.
Right.
Which are interesting things in that they have.
Zeolites. What is that?
Zeolites are actually volcanic in origin.
Yeah.
And they are very loose structured materials that have such large holes in them that things can go inside and be hidden from you. For example, they actually feed zeolites in chicken feed to keep chicken excrement from smelling.
That's interesting.
The holes aren't big enough to crawl into. They're big enough for small molecules.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
I understand. And they get trapped. And in fact, colloquially, they're known as molecular sieves. That they can.
But they've been around for a while. What's up?
What these are metal. The zeolites are all inorganic. They're minerals, basically. These have metal ions that hold together kind of struts of organic compound. That means you can tune them in all sorts of ways to make different pore sizes with different properties. So it ends up being that they have enormous surface areas because they have these channels that go through them. And they can absorb vast quantities of things like hydrogen so that they can be used to. If you add these to a compressed gas cylinder of hydrogen, you can, at the same pressure, get more hydrogen in there than you can
Oh, that's fascinating. So that would be a practical use for this?
That would be a practical use.
Okay.
As far as I know from what I've read, there haven't been any killer apps for these yet, but they're under investigation.
Okay. And if I remember,
where do you find zeolites?
Zeolites, usually in volcanic deposits, in ash deposits.
Hmm. And they're synthesized.
Right.
Oh, okay.
But if I remember right, one of the winners actually did his undergraduate degree at University at Albany.
No way.
Which is our local contact.
Interesting. That's great. It's the Science Forum today, 800-348-2551. If you have a science question, and the lines are starting to fill up, but we have a few open at the moment, 800-348-2551. You can email voxpop@wamc.org. Before we get to the phones, this is from John. And I showed you this video. He tried sending it, but our spam filter clamped out. So he says, this is the last time I'll plague you with this. And I know no pictures, no videos, but the attached video shows the feeder after filling it from a large container. While pouring the sunflower seeds lined up on the left side of the container with the smaller seeds on the right, there was no static because it's raining. I'm going with the Brazil nut effect, but is it a form of fluid dynamics? If you don't know what he's talking about, it's a bird feeder, basically, with different
tubular,
seeds.
Right. Vertical tubular bird feeder.
Right.
And he says the segregation happens while he's pouring it in?
Yeah. While filling it from a large container, yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So it is a fluid dynamics problem and exhibiting the Brazil nut effect.
Well, all right. Tell us what the Brazil nut effect
is. Brazil nut effect is that in a mixture of small things and big things,
right,
if there's energy applied to it, like vibrating it or freeze-thaw cycles, the big things will rise to the top because the little things can sneak in underneath.
Hmm.
And
they have smaller surface areas, so they migrate down below.
Sure, yeah. Makes sense.
So you get that self-segregation by size whenever there's that kind of energy applied to the system.
You know, a couple observations about this email. One, John is obviously very smart, but I don't know. He knows about fluid dynamics, so he's got some brains. But also, he's retired and clearly has too much time on his hands, right? Because, I mean, he's been thinking about this.
He's filming his bird feeder. I mean,
well, but he's also been thinking about this for a couple months now. All right, John, off the ledge, buddy. This is from Telesport in East Chatham.
Wait, before we get done with the Brazil nut effect, I have a question. I have a package of Brazil nuts at home. They're all the same size. You do not get big Brazil nuts and small Brazil nuts. So why is it called the Brazil nut effect?
Because in the mixed nuts, when you get Brazil nuts, as part of the mixed nuts.
Oh, so the filberts go to the bottom and the Brazil nuts go to the top.
Right.
Oh, my.
All right, four nuts talking nuts. Telesport in East Chatham says, could the panel explain why rolling rubber tires make a sound?
It's friction on the road.
Why are you answering all the questions, Jim?
I don't know.
I mean,
Barbara's not here.
Jumps in. I mean, all right. So that's it. Just
I think there's a couple of things. I think that you've got the friction. Mm-hmm. Okay. I think if the tires were slicks, they would make a lot less noise because they don't trap air in the treads.
Okay.
So that becomes a sound wave emanating from the tire. But basically, the friction that Jim referred to is a form of energy that's lost, right? It's a lost energy that's not moving the vehicle. So it's got to go somewhere. It goes to heat, goes to sound, goes probably to light. If you looked at it, there's probably some static light coming off of there.
You know, and you could probably test this by just pulling the car slightly to the right in the highway, and then that section of right before the shoulder where they have that noise-making thing in case you're sleeping and you wake right up. You know, didn't they do some experiment with that years ago?
They have it in San Francisco. They have it play Anaklanenok music.
That is crazy.
They have what?
they space the spaces such that when you're going over it, it goes... Yeah.
There's a scientist with a lot of time on his hands right
But
there.
I would say, as far as the tires are concerned, that the tire makes sound, but what you're really hearing is the vibration of the tire in the car, which is probably more important because it's the sidewalls of the tire that define how much of that sound actually gets into the car.
Oh, I'll be darned.
And once it gets into the car, then you've got effectively a resonator.
Resonant structure.
And that's going to increase certain, certain
sounds
and not
vehicle.
Others. Oh, yes.
So this is the same. Is this the same effect then when someone has a subwoofer in their car and you hear them on the street and it's so loud, you say, how do they survive? The bass is booming so loud, but it's not as bad inside, right? There's is the subwoofer just vibrating air molecules outside the vehicle?
Yeah, that's the case where it's the car actually acting as a vibrator for the outside.
That's so crazy.
Well, yeah, that and, you know, radiators, any kind of a radiator, any sort of a point source
yep.
has a near-field effect and a far-field effect. When you're in the near field where the fields don't fully define themselves in there, so it's conceivable that he could be hearing less sound inside. It's conceivable. I can't speak specifically. But on the outside where the fields start to form, you know, the waves come together and you get the sound.
Right. And the other possibility, of course, is the guy in the car may be totally deaf.
Exactly.
Well, yeah, that happens. In fact, my wife got in my car the other day and said, boy, you listen to the stereo really loud. And I said, it doesn't seem loud to me.
Right.
All right. Tell you what. Oh, by the way, while I have stereo guys here, Ed and Roger are stereo guys, passive radiators. How are they tuned? How do they do their job without sending all sorts of extraneous low end through the system?
Passive radiators?
Yeah, like my Klipp speakers have a big 12-inch passive radiator on the back, and they're tuned. They're not plugged into.
You're talking about a port on the speaker?
It's not a port. It's a passive radiator. It looks like a driver, but it's not connected to anything.
Oh. Well, it probably resonates and moves additional air with that resonance.
But how do they focus it? Ed, you must have had speakers with these.
Well, I try to have speakers without them.
Really? Why?
Yeah, because I don't want the speaker itself to change the sound that I'm hearing. The speaker enclosure is always tuned, and you have to be very careful about
the size
of it.
So you always go with closed enclosures?
No, I go for things like, what are they called?
Tuned port.
No, I don't have any ports at all.
Air suspension, then.
Marshall Logan type of speakers.
Oh, you have the planar.
Electrostatics.
Okay. Thank you.
So these work remarkably well. They're on the back of the speakers, and it'll crank a lot of bass out, and it doesn't seem to be. They must have tuned it very well because it doesn't.
Right.
It doesn't really boom or anything else.
Sure.
All right, let's take a quick break, and then we'll get to the phones. It's the Science Forum. We've been all over the place so far, and I'm sure that's the way it'll go for the rest of the show. 800-348-2551. Oh, now some nice exotica. All right, cue the birds. Here we go.
Oh, 800-348-2551.
It's a Science Forum. Fell asleep for a moment there with that lovely music. But now we're back to action, and let's go to the phones. We have Ed Stander here. We have Jim Pickett and Roger Jaboni, and we'll go to Richard in Pittsfield. Hello, Richard in Pittsfield.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
Hey, I'll give you a story, and hopefully this is the way to get to my problem.
Okay.
Let's say it's 10 in the morning on a Sunday, and I want to watch the morning shows, and I live in Pittsfield, and I have a uni antenna on top of my roof. I point it right at the Helderbergs, and I pick up all the stations, plenty of stations. And then I enjoy the shows, but I put the TV back on at 1 o'clock or 1:30 to watch a football game, not on CBS, but on Fox. And it comes in very garbled or not at all.
It's the NFL
obviously.
Blocking.
No.
And then by 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, as the sun is starting to go down, especially in September, the Fox station comes back in. No other stations are interrupted. And I'm not moving the antenna, and the leaves on the trees are the same no matter what station. What are your thoughts as to what's going on with this one channel?
Skipping?
Well, no. The issue is, I suspect, you know, VHF communications, which is the frequency that that is receiving at, is line of sight communications. Mm. The difference between analog television, which we had years ago, and the digital television, which is broadcast today, is that with analog television, the mind, you could watch shows and programs that were slightly degraded with noise, fuzzy. You could watch them. The digital interpolation equipment in the TV is much less forgiving of that. So when you get normal path, multipath or propagation disturbances on that, the digital channels just stop. They just cut out. You had said there were some that were garbled, but that's right before it cuts out.
But why only? Why is it fine in the morning and fine closer to nightfall? And at 1 o'clock, well, when the game is on, it's a problem.
There may be some specific atmospherics. You know, the Helderbergs get fog very, very regularly.
This guy's in Pittsfield.
Well, but he said he's pointing his antenna
at the Helderberg. No other station is lost. No other stations are lost. Yeah. That's, I mean, that one.
I have this problem sometimes, too, with the over-the-air channels.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of it may have to do with the strength of the signal as well.
Yeah, right. It has to be. It has to be. But as far as I know, TV, you know, some radio stations, especially AM stations back in the day, would have a nighttime power limit and a daytime power limit. I don't know about TV stations and what the rules are.
No, they don't.
But I wonder about VHF. I wonder about this, Roger. What if somebody, between the time that Richard's watching his cartoons in the morning and the time that he's going to watch the game at 1, what if there's some interference? Something turns on in the neighborhood, some sort of nearby frequency that just causes enough guff?
Well, I'm in the Pittsfield area. I'm not aware of anything in that frequency range that would come on in the during the day.
Hmm. Anybody?
Well, maybe just that the television doesn't like that station.
Yeah. I mean, where I am, Channel 6, I have a tough time because I understand Channel 6 is in a different location.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have an antenna that I can change the direction. You know, it's I don't even know how it works exactly, but you just turn the dial.
It's a phased array.
Phased array.
Right.
And I have to really change it almost 180 degrees to get Channel 6 clear.
I will tell you, I'm in the Pittsfield area in Lanesboro, and I have a digital antenna, and I get almost nothing on it.
Really?
Yeah, almost nothing.
Just get a preamp. That's what I ended up doing.
I bought the VC box.
What's the VC box?
That's a whole nother show.
Ah, all right, fair enough. Well, Richard, I'm sorry we couldn't give you a definitive answer, but...
I'll look into it and see where Fox is being broadcast from, because it's possible that it's not the same place in the Helderbergs.
I'm sure it's not.
I think it might be, it's Channel 23, but it might also be 51.
Mm-hmm.
Where does it come over, Richard? Real quick, we got to let you go.
Yeah, I got 23, and it's the classic. The other thing is that WTEN and Fox kind of share programming, and I get ABC, WTEN, fine, but I don't get this one.
Huh. Well, try 51, or maybe do another channel search, because I think that there are some redundant frequencies there. Hey, Richard, thanks a lot. 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. And let's go to Mike in Hudson. Mike, you're on.
Oh, hey, guys. Sounds like you got to work into a great other show all about this TV antenna topic. Okay,
yeah, right.
Here's my question. My question's about absolute zero. And if absolute zero is like a flat wavelength, if it's a complete cessation of atomic motion, but if motion is entirely relative, is it theoretically ever possible to get to actual absolute zero without heat death in the entire universe? That's my question.
Oh, well, that sounds like an Ed question. I don't know.
well,
go take it.
At absolute zero, you get zero vibration, zero motion of molecules relative to each other. You're right. It is relative. So it's relative to your thermometer, whatever it is that's measuring it. Now, the reason you can get really close to absolute zero, less than a millionth of a degree, I think. The reason you can't get all the way there is because you're coming only from one direction. And you can only decrease the vibration by increments. if you were trying to get to any temperature from only one direction, you would never actually be able to get there. You can get to a temperature only if you can, say you're coming from above, be able to drop below and zero in that way. So the reason you can't get to actual zero, well, plus there's quantum effects. You can't have zero motion, which is probably the real reason you can't get totally there.
So you could never get to absolute zero?
No. Yeah, that's right.
All right, Mike, what do you think of that?
I believe that answers my question. Thank you.
All right, well, thanks for the call. How about that? A satisfied customer. 800-348-2551 is the number. Let's go to Joan in Schenectady and see if we can continue this winning streak. Joan, you're on.
Hello, hello. I hope I don't disturb your winning streak. First, before I get to my questions, Ray, will you tolerate a very, very quick aside?
I suppose.
I want to compliment you. I know it's hard for you, but I want to compliment you on filling in for Lucas in the Midday Magazine.
Thank you. That show runs itself. The newsroom is so good I get in there and read. I'm like Ron Burgundy, it's easy.
I get that, and I accept your answer, except your professionalism just really, really shines there.
You're very kind. You're overstating it. I'm a semi-professional, Joan, and let's be honest, I have some cards made up that say semi-professional broadcaster. I'll give you one next time you're at the fun drive. So anyway,
I want one, but
what's up, friend?
Anyway, hey, my question has to do with two forms of poles or polarization. One, real quick, what is the declension I should give my compass when I'm looking for the magnetic north?
12 to 13 degrees.
15 degrees.
It's not that much.
15 degrees west, yeah.
What?
Gotcha.
Hang on.
I thought it was
15?
More than
it's 15 degrees.
Yeah.
Wow. Hang on. Yeah. These experts are really they're at odds now.
Well,
so.
it's the Russians. They've taken over
Darn
our North
those
Pole.
Russians.
Yeah.
All right. Fair
That's
enough.
What I thought. It was slipping to the west, and I wanted to set my compass correctly. Thank you.
Okay.
Now here's another type of polar light polarization. For the first time ever, I accepted polarized vision glasses.
Yeah.
Vision correction glasses.
Yeah.
And I know I'm not normal. is it normal that I'm always seeing a tiny orange stripe at the top of an object and a tiny blue stripe towards the bottom? Am I seeing auras? Because
no,
I've always seen auras.
You're seeing chromatic aberrations in your glasses.
So they're defects of the glasses?
They're defects of the glasses, yeah.
Interesting.
Aha!
So it's not you, Joan.
For being poor.
In this instance, it's not you.
And you get, thank you very much.
You get that especially on bright objects. Exactly. That's what causes that.
Interesting.
Chromatic aberrations.
I remember that the first time I ever tried polarized, my father had cool ray sunglasses back in the 70s, and I put them on. I could not believe how cool it was to look up at the sky and the clouds, and you could see the sun coming through the clouds. And I have them now on my glasses, and it's the only thing is, if I'm looking at my phone in some situations, you can't see it properly. You have to be looking directly at it.
Yeah, well, that's the polarization is not what's causing the aberration. That's just the glass itself that's doing that. And the best way to tell that is by looking through your glasses from the side. In other words, keep them on your face, but look at something from the sort of to the side of your glasses, and you'll have more of a curvature of your glass, and you'll see it more pronounced.
Okay, Joan, great call.
And I want to correct, Ed was correct. It is closer to 12 degrees.
Aha!
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Takes a big man to say that on the air. Thank
Especially
you.
On the air.
Joan, thanks very much. 800-348-2551. All right, let's see. Who's next? Oh, John is in Pittsfield. Hello, John, you're on.
Yeah, my question is about the Einstein-Borg controversy, and I know that's old, but I'm just wondering, has that ever been resolved? the fact that nothing can move faster than the speed of light, yet if the polarization is changed in one object, the effect on the other object is immediate, faster than the speed of light. Okay. Has that ever been resolved?
So this is the spooky action at a distance question. Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, the problem there comes in really in how it's put, in that one object is not affecting the other. It is that they are entangled from the start. Now, Einstein believed that there must be some hidden variables, that there's something there that we're just not being able to measure. It's only been fairly recently that that's been resolved, that there really is not. And there are not any hidden variables. In fact, that was the Nobel Prize in physics a couple of years ago. Now, it was not as much of a controversy between Bohr and Einstein, I think, as the folklore has.
There were no punches thrown or anything?
No.
Okay.
And it's a matter that this is something really weird in quantum mechanics, but it's kind of just the way it is. That when the things are entangled, they're joined by a wave function, but no information can be exchanged faster than the speed of light.
Okay.
So that, for example, if Ray across the table here has one particle and I have the other, and I measure polarization up, then I can predict that you will measure polarization down, but I can't convey that information to you any faster than the speed of light.
Aha. Okay. John, does that make sense?
It makes sense, but it doesn't answer my question.
Splendid.
I thought there was an experiment that was done that sort of proved that things can move faster than the speed of light. Now, I could be wrong. That's the real gist of my question. No. Was there an experiment that said, okay, we can move faster than the speed of light?
No.
Okay.
No. The only way you can move faster than light is not in a vacuum. So the spooky blue glow in nuclear cooling ponds, for example, how's it pronounced?
Cherenkov
radiation. So you've got particles moving faster than the speed of light in water.
Ah.
So you can do that.
Okay.
But you can't go faster than the speed of light in a vacuum.
That I have never heard that. John, thanks for the call. 800-348-2551 is our number. It's the Science Forum. That was Jim Pickett talking. We also have Ed Stander here and Roger Jaboni to answer your questions. Claryville is the place. Pete's the fella. Pete, you're on.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. My question is about the formation of gold in the universe. From what I understand, through spectral analysis of universal objects, there's more gold than can be accounted for by the known processes of formation. One is, for instance, two neutron stars that merge were thought to produce gold, and that is true, but they have found out that that is not always true. So there's a bit of a mystery about why there is so much gold. It's rare, but it's not that rare in the universe, and if that question has been answered or what the latest information is.
All right.
Thank you.
Well, what do you guys think? This might be an astronomy question for the astronomy show, but if you guys want to take a whack at it, go ahead.
I can tell you how much gold there is in the sun, and I can tell you how you get gold out of the ground. But as far as the amount of gold in the universe, that's a question that's beyond me.
All right. So I think that Pete. Oh, go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, I mean there are, as Pete alluded to, that there are processes that are known to produce gold, but I think he's right that it hasn't all been accounted for.
All right. I think, Pete, if you don't mind, next month we will have Dr. Valerie Rapson on and Bob Berman on, and I think that they might be able to give you a better answer on this regarding, second-generation stars and third-generation stars and things like that. But I think you might have stumped us to some extent, and thank you for the call. 800-348-2551 if you have a science question for our crew here. And we'll go to David in New Paltz next. David, you're on.
Good show, Ray.
Thank you.
My question is, in electric vehicles with electric batteries and all those magnets and everything else, how does that affect the people that are in the car, the electromagnetic force field in the human body? That's my question.
So I think that's a cool question.
It is an interesting question, and it probably affects people differently being immersed in a different magnetic field. But I will tell you that in terms of damage to the cellular structure, it has to be ionizing radiation, and none of that is ionizing radiation. It's there are magnetic fields and electric fields, and there may be some electromagnetic fields, but none of them are at an ionizing radiation level. So in terms of cellular damage, I don't think
so. Even if we were in the strongest possible magnetic field, we'd be fine?
They put people in MRI machines,
yeah, but
which
not
are
if
incredible.
You have,
well, if you have a piece of metal in you, it's
you
a different
a pin
story.
In your leg or right. your ankle or something. But yeah. We also have those elements in our body anyway, right?
I mean, the magnetic field is going to affect conductive liquid that moves. So you could get inner ear.
Interesting.
You could compare it. The ionizing radiation is like taking a sledgehammer to molecules. You break them up. You do chemistry, it can be not pretty. The electromagnetic fields are more like tickling the molecules. You're not breaking them up, you're not doing chemistry, but you can still move them around.
Even if
for
it's
example.
A super strongest yeah. magnetic field.
Yeah, this goes back to the quantum effects. You have to have the right frequency to be absorbed by the molecule
yeah.
to break a bond.
And it's typically the water resonant frequency.
Right. So like, for example, the very strong radio waves tickle the water molecules and heat them up.
Yeah.
So if you stand in front of a radar emitter, you can get cooked.
Yeah. Okay.
Because of the interaction, what happens is the
resonances yeah. within the molecules yeah. and they absorb the energy, which eventually becomes heat,
right?
Which is how your microwave oven works,
right? Yes. And it's all about duty cycle when you're standing in front of one of these transmitters. Hey, yeah. David, we're out of time before the break here, but that was a good one. Let's take that break. 800-348-2551 is the number. voxpop@wamc.org is the email address. Science Forum, we'll be back. The Skinny, and I think that's in the garden. I'm not sure the name of that. Yeah, Zach, thank you. 800-348-2551 is our number. Science Forum today with Ed Stander, Jim Pickett, Roger Jaboni. Barbara Brabets has the day off. You know what? We don't pay her, so she can take a day off when she wants. You know what? This has been such a great show. We can only make it better by going to Argyle and talking to Merle. Merle, you're on. Or not. Merle, did you put your hearing aids in? Last time, Merle was making a sandwich during the when he was on hold. All right, Merle, I'm giving you 3 seconds, and very slow. One Mississippi, two Mississippi.
Oh, can you hear me now?
It's about dang time. You got the two Mississippi. Hello, Merle, you're on.
I unplugged the hearing aid.
Darn it.
I got two questions. You guys can pick which one to ask.
All right.
Answer.
Okay.
One has to do with fireplace ash reigniting.
Okay.
I didn't like the way you said it, the answer.
Yeah, you asked this
before.
Question. All right. So you're going to ask it again of the
and
same
the
people.
Other one, yeah. Well, at least one was there, though,
okay.
I think.
All right, fine.
Anyway, And the other one is, how come there's a delay in my fingers when I pick up a hot piece of coal? It doesn't register for several seconds that I just picked up a hot
That's a great question. But can I ask you a question? Why are you picking up hot coal with your fingers?
I thought it was a piece of bark.
Okay. All right. Just back off, Merle. All right. Let's go to the questions. One, the fireplace ash that reignites. Merle asked this question before and didn't like the answer. So what do you think?
I think we need more details. Under what circumstances did it reignite, Merle?
That I can do. All right. The fireplace ash that I'm putting in my bucket is next to the fireplace. I set aside the ash, and I go through it and clean it. In other words, I take out all the pieces of charcoal that I reburnt. So there's not anything hot going into the ash bucket.
Okay.
Now, once in a while, because I smoke in front of the fire, and I roll my own, and sometimes the cigarette falls apart, and the hot part goes right into the ash.
Sure.
And I have noticed that reignites the ash.
Okay.
It probably reignites the gases.
Oh, interesting.
That are being produced by what's left of the coal in the ash.
That's not completely burning.
It's not completely burned.
Right.
Fascinating.
But it burns all the way down, like 3-4 inches into the ash bucket.
Huh.
I mean, it's not just surface where I'm talking about. I'm saying that the can was like red hot, 6 inches down.
Merle, you're violating the
and
laws of physics.
I haven't a clue.
There is a reason that they tell you to put your ashes in a metal bucket and put the lid on the bucket.
Get rid of the air.
Right.
Aha. Uh-huh. All right. Now, what about Merle, who by mistake picked up a piece of hot coal, thinking it was a piece of bark, and there was a delay from the time that he picked it up until the time he felt searing pain in his digits?
It's for the same reason you can walk across burning coals. It is that the coal does not conduct heat very well.
Oh.
So when you touch it, you cool off the top, and it takes a little while for the bulk to heat it back up again it feels hot again.
Yeah.
It's for the same reason like a piece of steel feels cool, because it's a really good conductor of heat. So it transfers the heat from your fingers into the bottom.
Amazing.
There's
so
a quickly. There's a second part to
Thank
that, too.
Thank you very much. You just put it up.
He bought that one.
This time he bought it.
One for two.
Sorry.
You want to finish up, Ed?
I can just mention that your fingers have moisture on it, and it takes a certain amount of time for the moisture to evaporate.
Aha.
And as it evaporates, you also don't feel the
All
heat.
Right. Yeah. Merle, do me a favor. Yeah. Don't walk on any coals before the next show, and we will talk to you. Thank you. Let's go to Nico in Chatham. Nico, you're on.
Hi. I have a question about recording studio monitors, speakers, and I was wondering what makes the difference between midfield monitors and main monitors.
What kind of frequencies
that they cover and what makes you able to hear them at different distances.
It's placement, right? And driver size?
Well, like any point source radiator, the waves come together and form, fronts that can move the air correctly. And it's based on the angle that the speaker is pitched at, the size of the speaker. So that's what makes them. If you've ever seen pictures of the Grateful Dead's Wall of Sound, they learned how to vertically stack speakers so that they could get the far field of the radiation out into the audience. Does that help?
Great.
All right, Nico, thanks a lot. You know, I've been looking at, for my little studio setup at my house, these little monitors, single, and I forget who makes them, a Vantone or something, but they're little tiny speakers. And from what I understand, mixing people say, yeah, you want to mix stuff so that it sounds great, even on lousy.
Yeah, I mean, the concept of a monitor speaker is somewhat of a misnomer. Monitors generally are not full bandwidth speakers. They're just designed so that the guitarists can hear their own vocals or their own instrument or something like that.
Well, by the same token, there are studio monitors.
Monitors.
And to me, I mean, you hook them up to a stereo, they sound really, really good. They're just very accurate, I think, and they try to avoid the coloration of sound.
There's no, right. There's, right.
All right, so that's that. Oh, boy. Let's go to Pittsfield, and it's Stephen's turn.
The city of Pittsfield shut down today to call the radio show.
This question is a good one. Stephen, go ahead.
Hey, guys. This I think, is a physics question, or it may just be a silly question. If it's raining outside, and you've got to go out, and you've got to get from point A to point B, because I've studied my windshield when I'm stopped at a light versus moving slowly versus moving quickly, it seems like you'll get just as wet between the same point A and point B, whether you run or walk.
That's exactly.
Is that true?
That's exactly right.
So all these people running through the rain are idiots.
Well, not necessarily, Stephen.
Well, running in the rain, you're going to get more rain in your face if you don't have a wide-brimmed hat.
Right.
But you're going through. You can imagine. Do a little matrix thing here where you freeze the raindrops in place.
Yeah.
You got to walk through the same number of raindrops, whether it's you're going fast or slow.
Yeah, the difference is how wet you feel.
Yeah.
Because if you're going fast, then the stuff doesn't soak through your clothes quite so fast. And as a result, you feel less wet when you get there.
And you'll get fewer raindrops coming straight down on your head.
Right.
Because that
it comes vertically.
That's a function of how long you're there. So running in the rain is the right thing to do.
Wow. That was a great question, Stephen.
Well, I've wondered about it for years, and here you guys are. You're answering it for me. I'm done. Wow, that's awesome.
We talk about this one all the time.
Yeah, we do. Thanks for that. 800-348-2551. Let's see. We had Merle from Argyle. How can we up our game here? Let's go to Chris in Housatonic. Chris, you're on.
Yeah, I was wondering something. I was reading about the Blackbird, and was wondering, how fast is Mach 6?
So the SR-71 Blackbird is what you're talking
Mach
about,
6
right?
is six times the speed of sound at sea level, which is about 1,100 feet per second.
So it's 4,500 miles an hour, something like that.
330 meters per second.
Any of those will work.
Just about 4,000.
Yeah.
Because what it is, it's...
The other question I had is, since we have black holes in space, are there any black holes in the oceans?
Huh.
No, not as far as anybody knows. I mean, it is possible that black holes can, little teeny black holes...
Are all over the place. Maybe.
Could be all over the place, could pass through, and you never know.
Yeah.
But as far as anybody knows, there aren't any.
Huh. Well, that's a great one. Thanks, Chris. Appreciate it. Let's go now to Washington, Massachusetts. And Michael, you're on.
Oh, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
You bet.
This is a question about something that happened 50 years ago to me. I was in a high school chemistry lab, and I stood up and announced that I couldn't do the lab because I had to go to my grandfather's funeral. And then, as it turns out, 300 miles away, he had dropped dead of a heart attack. And pretty well documented. I talked to people who had been in the room afterwards. You know, I didn't imagine that I said that. But I've always wondered, is there any physical explanation for information traveling at that scale?
Well, you're talking metaphysics now, unfortunately.
I dig it, though. I mean, I can see where you're going with this, but who can prove it? It's unknowable, right?
I felt it. I felt it before. I found out before I knew my brother had passed away that my brother had passed away.
Yeah.
It's one of those things that happens, and you really can't explain it.
I don't know, man.
It's pretty common for people to report this. And I've never had any other experience like it for the rest of my life. And I had thought that maybe it was like a wave skip on AM radio where something bounces off of a cloud inversion, and so you can hear Vancouver radio if you're on Long Island.
I mean, you can't prove it. I mean, you could maybe. Who knows, man? I mean, but that is between that is in the great unknown. I mean, I don't think we can do a scientific test that could prove that sort of thing.
If we could, we'd get the Nobel Prize.
Yes, and as opposed to the Ig Nobel Prize. You weren't here last time.
Oh, I suggested the Ig Nobel Prize.
And we did talk about it. Barb talked about it quite a bit. Did you want to weigh in on that at all?
No, but I think it was brilliant to take cows and paint them like zebras, and I would have done that if I had thought of it first.
Maybe do a different animal next year and you can get yours. Yeah. Hey, I paint a pig with red and blue. You know what I mean? Mets colors. Kim in Saratoga. Kim, you're on.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have a question, something that happened when I was a kid living in Ballston Spa. And at one end of our family room, there was a glass door. And at the other end, there was a sliding glass door. And one evening, we were sitting watching TV, and a ball of light flew through the front door, past us, and out the back door, through the glass.
That is so cool. What color was it?
White.
Yeah, okay. Ball lightning.
Yep.
Or St. Elmo's fire. There are a couple of different names for it.
Yep, a little ball of plasma.
Right.
And if it hit Kim, could Kim have been harmed?
That I don't know.
So how does that happen? I mean, my whole lifetime, and up until, and my dad, it was my dad, myself, and my brother who witnessed this, and we never really knew what it was. Well, and my dad, before he died, he's like, you have to find out.
So wow, that's so
cool. I'm calling to find out.
Kim, was there an electrical storm going on at the time?
Not that I remember, no.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, that doesn't mean that there couldn't have been static electricity activities going on in the atmosphere. Something had to create the energy to form the plasma.
Yeah.
And it was summer. I do remember that.
There you go.
Summertime.
Yeah. Plasma is just, if you take a gas and you heat it up to a certain temperature, around 3,000 degrees, then it becomes a plasma.
But how? Now, if ball lightning was one of those things that they said, well, it's not real until enough people saw it. How would you make a coherent ball of plasma that could travel through windows and go through walls?
It is very mysterious. And the problem is that there's no way to study it. I don't think that it's ever been found a way to
catch one.
So we can't reproduce it at this time.
Make it on demand.
We make plasmas all the time.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But a plasma is nothing unusual about making a charged ball of gas.
Right. But making one that floats around is...
It stays together.
I don't think has been done.
But if you look under if you read about St. Elmo's fire, it's going back into the...
Columbus.
Since Christ was in short pants.
Really?
Yeah,
did he wear short pants? Kim, you're lucky. I think that's so cool, and that's a great... Somebody will figure it out someday, but thank you for that. That's a great, great story, and I consider you lucky. Let's quickly... You know what? This has been a red letter show. Let's go to Jim in Matamoros. Jim, you're on.
Two questions. Is the capacitor the part of the camera that's most likely to get fried when the camera gets wet?
Capacitor in a camera or TV?
Yeah. Camera.
Yeah, the capacitor would be very, very likely to get fried simply because it's what's conducting and saving as much electricity to make it go off.
You're saying gets wet. You mean the camera got drenched or dropped in a bucket of water or something? Likely that what happened is the moisture... Go ahead.
We only have about 30 seconds.
I washed my pants and forgot and left the camera in it.
Yeah, likely what happened is water and or soap suds got on a printed circuit board, and it reduced the conductivity and probably damaged some of the chips inside.
All right. And then you had another question very quickly. We only have 15 seconds.
Last year we could get all of the TV channels except RFD TV. And this year, we can't get any of the HD channels except our RFD.
Oh, interesting.
TV.
All right. Well, we're almost out of time. That sounds like an antenna issue. Sounds like you're...
Propagation
issue.
Yeah. Right.
All right. We got to go. That was a lot of fun. Ed, how are things going over at the school?
Absolutely wonderful.
Do you enjoy
Couldn't
your work?
Be better. I love my work.
Okay. Jim, how's retirement?
Well, it's okay. I'm finishing up things on my consulting gig, and I've got a lot to do before the end of the year.
Roger, how is the hi-fi biz?
Hey, it's going. It's going. There are still people that enjoy component stereo systems.
And how is the boating thing going?
The boating thing was fun this year.
We got to talk about that next time.
We took a bunch of people out.
All right, everybody. Thanks for being here. Support comes from Glimmer Glass Film Days, Cooperstown, the 13th annual celebration of independent films, books, and art with events throughout Cooperstown, November 13th through 17th. GlimmerGlassFilmDays.org. At California Closets, Albany showroom on Route 7, Latham, working to help clients organize their home this fall with custom built-ins, garages, mudrooms, and more, CaliforniaClosets.com. Thanks again to Ed, Roger, and Jim for being here today. Thank you for listening. Tremendous calls today. So many of them. Sorry if we didn't get to yours. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Susie Checkeye screened the calls. Thanks, Susie. Tomorrow it's Food Friday. It's Halloween. So what do you think? We'll do some candy, right? Nope. It's vegetarian food with our buddy Wendy Grossman. We'll see you at 2 p.m.